Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 18th of December. Our guest this hour wrote a piece that caught our attention in the New York Times, November 30th, The Real Humanities Crisis. He says that the words of the day in discussions of the humanities are this, that only 8% of undergraduates major in humanities, but the figure is misleading. It doesn't include majors in closely related fields, history, journalism, and some of the social sciences, and it also doesn't take into account many of the required and elective humanities courses that students take outside their majors. The humanities is a big part, really, of all of our lives, but it's hard to make a living in the humanities, and maybe we ought to think about that fairly seriously. He offers some very interesting suggestions of what we could do to open up a large number of fulfilling jobs for people in the humanities. And our guest is Professor Gary Gutting. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, editor of Notre Dame Philosophical Reviews, and author of Thinking the Impossible, French Philosophy Since 1960. The Place of the Humanities, this hour of the program, we're particularly interested in hearing from, and I'm sure there are many of you who are in this category who majored in some kind of humanities field and what you did with that major. And when you look at your salaries and compare them with people who were in business or some other field where making money is easier, where do you find yourselves after you've been in a profession in for some period of time? We'll talk about all of that this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Gary Gutting, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So a professor of philosophy, sir, that's very impressive. How did you decide you were going to enter philosophy? And it was a field, I'm sure, that you must have had some trepidation somewhere along the line. Oh, my gosh, am I going to ever find work in this field?
Actually, I'd never had any thoughts like that at all.
Really?
I had been interested in philosophy. I got interested in very early, even in late grade school, certainly through high school. And I knew when I started college that that's what I wanted to do. And I was lucky, however, I must say, because I actually went through college when there was a big thrust in education. This was right after the Sputnik development. The United States decided, well, we had to really get going on science education and education in general. So there was a lot more support for it. And at the time I came out in philosophy in the late 60s, there were still quite a few jobs. I had a choice of three good jobs when I after I had just graduated with a PhD in philosophy. So It's not like that anymore, that's for sure.
Right.
It wasn't so hard for me.
And when you think about it, Professor Gutting, of all the fields of study, the study of philosophy, you would think there would be all kinds of jobs in the field, because what better thing is there to study than how we live and why we live and what great thinkers have thought about all of that? It's an important field to being a human being.
Yeah, I don't know how much trouble people who are philosophy majors actually have getting good jobs. What the problem that comes up in for the more practical minded people is understandable. I mean, what do the parents say when the kid comes home now at say Christmas, a first year student, and says, "Well, I've decided I'm going to major in philosophy." What they say is, "Well, what are you going to do with that?"
Right.
And apparently, there's not supposed to be any answer. Well, what I always tell students, and I think it's the total truth, is what you should say to your parents is, well, I understand why you would ask what it is I'm going to do with a philosophy major, because unlike other majors, there are so many things that I could do and so many different kinds of places I could take up in society and do a lot of good. I mean, if you get trained as an engineer, an aeronautical engineer, well, you know what you're going to do, and there are probably lots of jobs there, but it's a very focused, specific thing. Same way with various kinds of business majors. You're going to be an accountant and so forth. Those kinds of jobs are reassuring to parents, because what parents, and I know as a parent that this is the kind of thing you think, well, I want to know what it is that the kid is going to be doing and that it's going to be worthwhile and fulfilling and so forth. And if you've got this profession, you know, I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm an engineer, we can see what that is. We know what it's going to be like. People who major in humanistic disciplines in particular have a wide range of abilities, the ability to read very well, to understand, to express themselves, and as you're pointing out, an understanding of what life is all about, or at least a lot of interesting questions they can ask about that, all of which can serve them in various different ways in lots of different contexts. But there's no specific one where you can say, well, this is what you'll be doing. So sometimes I think it's the overabundance of possibilities for humanities majors that puts people off.
Oh, that's a nice way to look at it. All the possibilities. Let's talk about the crisis. You say that the words of the day in discussions of the humanities are only 8% of undergraduates major in humanities, but you also say that that figure is misleading. How is it misleading?
Yeah, that is deeply misleading, and a lot of commentators have made the point, although the headlines seem to always get thrown back to crisis, decline, only 8% are majoring in humanities. Part of that is due to just a statistical kind of fluke. When people first started seeking data about this, the easy-to-access government figures, federal government figures, began in 1967. And in 1967, I think there were around 14 to 16% humanities majors, and now there are only 8%. The thing is, the late 1960s, I was mentioning this especially in terms of my own personal remarks, that was high tide. That was a bubble, actually. There was a tremendous interest in the humanities that developed over the 60s, and it came to a peak right in about 67, 68, when they chose to start the statistical look. And what happened was, fairly soon, by the 80s, it went back down to the 8 to 10% that, in fact, had always been the percentage of students majoring in the humanities. So maybe if you think that figure is critical and calling for a crisis, well, it's been around for a very long time. It's been around for the last 30 years, and except for a peaking in the 60s, it was even before that, from World War II on. One reason for that is that there are some funny ways statisticians sometimes have of saying what is the humanities. For instance, they often don't count the visual arts or the performing arts, and those that's tripled over the last number of years and adds a lot more to it. They also don't count anything in the social sciences, but especially at undergraduate major level, a lot of work in the social sciences, say in psychology, sociology, anthropology, is much less empirical and much more humanistic, really. Also, of course, they're forgetting completely about the fact that you don't have to major in a subject
right.
to have it be an important matter for you and you're to be interested in it. In fact, of course, as anybody who's been through college knows, you almost always have various sorts of required courses in the humanities, which people very much like and get very interested in and very involved with. Some of the best philosophy students I've ever had at the undergraduate level are engineers. They've got a mind for it. They love it. They like to have something that's not purely quantitative and that they can talk about meaningful human problems, and they're terrific at it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get a tremendous amount of out of a college experience with the humanities, even if you're not majoring in it.
Mm-hmm. But when you get out of school, you talk about an economic reality here. And if
mm-hmm.
you're going to be a lawyer, if you're going to be working on Wall Street, we know that your salaries are going to be higher, and you cite how much higher, which is pretty dramatic in your piece.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the people who, because you're with these people all the time. We've heard a lot that there is more of an emphasis now on doing work where you know you're going to make a good, solid living, and you may not be that interested in the subject matter, but you're going to make a good buck. Is it
yeah.
money that's motivating a lot of your students now, or there are a huge number of people who would like to be in the humanities and find jobs in the humanities, but need to be able to have more jobs in schools or teaching or whatever, and also need to
yeah.
be able to make more money
yeah.
to support a
yeah.
family?
Yeah. I think the money thing is overemphasized. I mean, it's true you can look at statistics, and I think they're something like that humanities majors on average start around $31,000 a year, and if you are a business student, you'll start at about 25% higher than that, and so on. that people think, I think what you naturally think is, oh, well, so then majoring in business gets you a job with more money. But actually those statistics show only a correlation, right? It turns out that people who major in business do make more money than people who major in humanities. But the question is why? Is it the fact that they've had this training in their business major and that's the cause of it? It might well be, and I think there's a lot to be said from this from students I've talked to, that people who major in business have a strong interest in making more money. That's an important goal for them. That's
right.
Why they switched to doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Many people will major in the humanities knowing and not really terribly worrying about the fact that they aren't going to make as much money. It doesn't mean they're not going to have a good, reasonable living. I mean, look, university professors are probably the best example. Virtually anybody who's a successful university professor has a tenure-track job at a mainline university could have gone into, say, getting an MBA or going to law school and would be making considerably more money. And they all know that. But almost all of us say we would much rather have the life of the humanities professor than the life we would have otherwise. So I'm not saying that this is what everybody should do, but I'm saying if that's your preference, of course, you'll be happy to take a somewhat lower salary. Right? I mean, a full professor at University of Wisconsin, I'm guessing, probably makes around $150,000 a year, at least at a certain level, and maybe a comparable lawyer make $300,000 to $400,000. Well, you know, is it going to say that makes it ridiculous, it makes it silly to take the job as a university professor? No, it's not true, because many people are much more fulfilling their own personal desires in life in their work. And that's the issue I would really want to emphasize, that we have a very strange idea in our society. Well, it's not strange, because we have a capitalist society, and this is what it puts forward. And that is that the point of working is only an instrumental thing. Work is for some other purpose than the work. It's as though you say, I do this, but not for its own sake. That's what work means. I don't do it for its own sake. I'd rather not be doing it. There's just a result I want, and for our capitalist society, the result is usually the money that you make. But that's really not the best way. That's one way to think about work, but you have to also think about work as itself a means of fulfilling yourself in your life. Aristotle, the old Greek philosopher, is quite good on that. He says that the purpose of work, of course, is leisure. And that stuns us when we read it. We think, no, the purpose of work is get money, right? Aristotle says, no, the purpose of work is to put yourself in a situation where you don't have to work, and then you can engage in leisure activities. But you might think, well, that just means sitting around and doing nothing, sitting in a rocking chair or whatever. But what Aristotle means is that instrumental labor that gets you your living earned allows you to have leisure during which you can do the work that really matters to
mm-hmm.
you, the more creative work, the more fulfilling work. And we should think more that way.
But when you talked about salaries and university professor, a lot of people will say $150,000. Well, you're just doing fine, thank you. I'm a musician,
sure.
Or I'm a dancer, or I'm a
Absolutely.
Teacher, and I'm making
yeah.
not much more than 30 if I'm making that. So
That's
how do we...
Good.
How do we address those people? Because it's hard to live on that amount of money, and
yeah,
it's fulfilling.
Yeah, this was the point. Yeah, the point of my article was to say the problem of that's the crisis, if you like to call it that. But the major problem for the humanities is we don't have enough jobs, or we don't have jobs for people who have humanities sorts of interest, humanistic sorts of interest, that will be fulfilling for them. And the performing artist people are the best example of this. It's a really absurd situation. For instance, there are people in I spent a lot of time in Chicago, and it's a wonderful center for theater and so forth, and there are all sorts of terrific actors, but it's darn few of those actors, even ones that are quite successful, equity actors regularly in shows, who can actually make a living simply by the work that they do. Same thing's true of musicians, right? You can be a musician, yes, if you're in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, then you're doing okay, you're fine, but there are hundreds and thousands of superb musicians in a metropolitan area, who at the best can piece together a minimal sort of get by living with, say, giving lessons and picking up various gigs here and there in an ad hoc way. We don't have jobs like that. Now, for example, in that regard, if we had, supposing it was just the custom in the United States, we all expected this, that in every town of any size, any reasonable size, there would be a first-class repertory company of actors that put on plays regularly who were made up of citizens of that town, and that was their full-time job. If we thought that way and we thought that was something that was important to do, there would be a lot of jobs for those sorts of people. Now, it requires a transformation in how we think, but it would make for a lot more fulfilling jobs. So there's an example of what we would have to do to make work meaningful for people.
Mm-hmm. And we already do that, as you cite in the article, for our sports teams, even at high school level, certainly at college level, and no doubt for professional level, that in a way we're sort of have a socialist system when it deals with sporting teams.
Absolutely. I was quite struck. Just as I was thinking about that, I read an article in the London Review of Books where someone from England was talking about sports and so on, and he made the interesting point, which I picked up on, that although Americans think of European countries as much more socialistic than we are, in athletics, we have what we would ordinarily regard as a socialistic system, an enormous amount of government support from the federal government with the special tax-exempt status that they give, for instance, the National Football League, and then all of the money poured into stadiums and other aid for professional teams, even by local governments, and then of course universities, which are a tremendous support for what are really minor leagues for professional football and basketball sports.
Yeah, right.
So but we are. If you mean by socialism owning the means of production, that's not what we're talking about. But if you think heavy government involvement and subsidy in a certain enterprise, sports is heavily subsidized by our government.
So should we do the same for the arts, and if so, how?
Well, I think we should do the same thing for the arts, and you have to work out how you're going to do it. One thing is, I don't think they require anything like the massive amounts of funding. You don't have to. Well, the example I used in my article, which you might remember, was in Minneapolis. The state legislature recently, I gather, voted to simply give $500 million to the Vikings to help build a new football stadium. And at the same time, roughly, the Minnesota Symphony was undergoing immense financial problems and still is perhaps on the verge of collapse over them, had to cancel their season and everything, because they had a continuing deficit of $6 million a year. Nobody knows where to get the money from. Well, they know where to get the money for $500 million for the Vikings. So it's not that much that's often needed, but it could be supplied easily.
Our guest this hour is Professor Gary Gutting. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, editor of the Notre Dame Philosophical Review, and his column, The Real Humanities Crisis, appeared recently in the New York Times. We'll put it, if we haven't already, on our Facebook page so you can read it as we talk. So we brought forward a number of different ideas here. Is there a real crisis in the number of young people who are studying humanities? Are there a lot of jobs that are available? Should you decide to be a philosophy major or a drama major or a performing artist major or a language major? Is there a way for us, because when it comes right down to it, that's what makes life worth living, or the arts in many ways, the humanities, right? It's what makes us human. So is there a way to open up more jobs in those fields? Should we subsidize those as we do with sporting teams? And there's a lot of issues on the table, so feel free to take any part that you would like to this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave your comments there. For those of you who are listening who majored in the humanities, I'm interested in knowing what you did with your degrees. Did you find that there were jobs available to you? Did you have to do a couple jobs to do what it was that you loved? Do you see a significant difference between those who were humanities majors, who were your friends, and those who were business majors? Were they able to find all kinds of employment and have fairly good salaries? Well, lines are open for you right now. Let's talk. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Professor Gary Gutting, and we'll start with Charlie in Milwaukee. Hello, Charlie.
Oh, thanks so much for taking the call.
Sure.
I must say I enjoyed the professor's comment that you don't have to major in philosophy to necessarily get a taste of philosophy in college, and that is truthfully something that I think all of us need is a little taste of the humanities. But I do wonder about the people who borrow to go to college to fund an education and then find themselves with very limited means to pay back that loan. I mean, if they do something that they enjoy and find fulfilling but can't find meaningful revenue afterwards, it's just a hobby. It's not a job, and there's a lot of problems with that. Wonder what you had thought. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the call, Charlie.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge problem, the financing of public of education nowadays, and the costs have gotten very high. Mainly, I would want to say, because of a withdrawal of public funds from public education. At the university level, for example, most of the great flagship universities in the states get what maybe 10 or 15% of their budget from the government, and that's a drop from what it has been in many cases. So we've withdrawn in that regard, and that's posed a lot of crisis for a lot of people. On the other hand, I would like to say that I don't know that there's very good evidence that you are particularly at a huge disadvantage in education if you don't plan to go into a higher paying job area, because you can gear what you're going to do. Well, you go to a certain kind of school to get an education, and there are various levels of expense that you can put out for that. I mean, if you go to a very good state university or the branch of a state university, it can be quite inexpensive, relatively speaking, and it won't compare with these sticker prices that you see, you know, of $30,000, $40,000 a year, which is what you would pay if you're paying full tuition at a private school. You can go for much less to an extraordinarily good state university or even a branch of a state university. In fact, from that point of view, the current lack of jobs for humanities PhDs has been a big help to the student in this sense, that it used to be that the very best humanities students, PhDs, all went to about 15 or 20 absolutely top universities and were completely congregated there. Nowadays, they go to almost any place that's a respectable university, anywhere in the country, whether it's a mainline one or a branch of a state university, and you've got extraordinarily good humanities departments in almost every college that you could go to. So you can get a tremendous education much more readily than people, say, 50 years ago could have done. So there are a lot of problems with it, and I think we need a lot more of state support for education, which we've had more in the past, and we keep withdrawing from it. But there are strategies that I think you can follow.
Mark in Duluth is next. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was a humanities major. I majored in music, a performance major, and I'm just driving home right now. Actually, I just pulled over here because I didn't want to drive while I was.
That's better. Yeah,
I was driving home now from my job that is not in the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up going back to school. I went to a Votech, a trade school, for electronics degree.
Mm-hmm.
And getting jobs in the humanities pretty difficult.
It's
with a
hard,
bachelor's degree in music, you're either going to be a teacher. Or you're going to be a teacher, or you're
going to... Yeah. Are you still doing... Are you doing... Mark, are you still doing music in some way?
Yeah, I'm a professional musician. I still play.
Okay.
And I was a professional musician before I went to school for music. So, you know, and that was kind of part of the reason why I chose the degree that I chose, is because I knew several people who had degrees. I knew a guy who had an English degree, I knew a person who had a biology degree. None of these people were working in their degree fields. So when I went to school, I figured, well, if that's the way it's going to work, I might as well go study what I'm interested in.
What you want, at least for 4 years, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's kind of was my logic behind it. But anyway, yeah, I just thought I'd call in and
thank
put
you.
In my 2 cents.
All right, thanks. I'm glad you did. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, I think this is a illustration of a very important problem. The way I put it in the article was this. We have a current tremendous worry, and quite rightly, about this tremendous stress that's being put on our middle class. But what we mean by that is the economic middle class. The wealth is all going to the top, right? And there's less and less for our middle class, and the middle class people economically are being very straitened. What we don't think about, though, is that there is a comparable problem with regard to what you might call the cultural middle class. So I'm not talking about your economic status. I'm talking about your cultural status. If you have an enormous amount of, say, musical ability, enough to be an outstanding concert pianist or a member of one of the major symphony orchestras or a international opera singer, you have a very fine, very satisfying life in terms of that humanistic interest, and you make a great deal of money. If you go anywhere below that elevated list, if you're not, in other words, if you're not one of the super rich, culturally speaking, there's virtually nothing for you in terms of satisfactory life employment. You have to do just as our caller did, say, well, I have to go to a trade school and learn something to get a job of any sort, right? You can't make it as a professional musician unless you, well, usually what you do is you, I think, patch together three or four different jobs, and even then probably have to have a spouse you're married to who will get you some health insurance, for example, and provide something more than just a basic living. That's an example of what I'm talking about. And we don't even think there's anything odd about it. We say, oh, well, if you're interested in that, if you're interested in music or theater, or if you're interested in literature, of course, there probably won't be a place for you in the society, economically speaking. That's we've just almost eliminated a meaningful cultural middle class of people engaging in jobs that express their cultural interests. The one exception, of course, as our caller was rightly saying, was teaching. And I think that there's some real possibilities there, because we do need desperately an influx of a very high level, what I call an elite professional class of teachers, drawn from the same kind of pool that our doctors and our lawyers and our engineers is drawn, namely the top 10 to 20% of the graduates of our good colleges. We could, if we made the effort and the commitment, make those people the ones who are the mainstay of our K-12 educational system. But we don't do that, because we simply won't pay the salaries needed, and even more important, we will not put the money into the schools to see that teaching in the ordinary K-12 school is a humanly fulfilling thing to do for people with these cultural.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. We'll talk more about that in a moment. We have a caller who is going into teaching, a humanities major, Maggie in Wauwatosa. Hi, Maggie.
I graduated from Lawrence University in 2011, and teaching or library science is on the extended plan right now. But I knew going in as a Latin major and art history major that things weren't going to be so smooth. So I made a plan to stay in retail and then get certified in massage therapy. So I have, like the previous caller, a plan to get the trade training and then mm-hmm. ultimately get back into it. So I covered all my bases, and I would do it all over again.
So you're happy. You're happy with it. But the cultural interest will be, what, a kind of part-time hobby sort of thing, as one of our callers said.
Yes.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think that's wonderful, and people do wonderful things of that sort. But it does seem to me we could... I'm not trying to say we could just overnight do this, but if we could readjust our thinking in our society, we could open ourselves to the possibility that people like you, who are interested in Latin and art history, what a terrific combination of things to be doing, could actually, you know, teach in a high school, teach that sort of thing, do a wonderful job for the students, for yourself, and be living. Your work would not just be for the sake of the money that you're getting. It would be part of the fulfilling life you're leading.
Maggie, what do you
absolutely
what do you really want to do? If you could just, you know, have your perfect job, it would be what?
I would be a full-time Latin teacher.
Okay. Yeah, that would be good.
Latin teacher at the university level, and he loves it. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Maggie. Thanks very much for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Christine in Madison. Hi.
Hello. This is an emotional question for me because I advised undergraduates at the University of Wisconsin for 23 years, and that's academic advising about helping them with their classes and what do you need and this and that. And we are focusing too much on if I take a major in something that I like, that means that's the job I'm going to have. Business, engineering, those kinds of things are professional degrees. People who do the humanities and letters and science are getting a skill set. People who learn languages are working internationally. They travel. But what I think the best example I can give is a cousin of mine who is in his probably about 60 now, was saying, you know, I did my undergraduate degree in broadcasting. I have never had a job in broadcasting, but I had to change jobs 5 times in my life, and that degree helped me because it taught me how to learn. And when I changed those jobs, I knew how to learn the skills of the job. I had really good skills, and we totally miss that. We think, you know, this is so emotional for me because for 23 years I've been trying to explain to parents who probably didn't know what they were going to do with their humanities major, what job their kids were going to get. So can we really think about skill sets, learning to be a citizen, learning to read, how to process, how to learn when you're training for a new job? Could we ever think of that? And I'll take my answer off.
All right, thanks.
This just drives me nuts.
All right. Thanks, Christine, for your call.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true and extremely well put, I thought. Comes back to a point I made very early on in our discussion, and it particularly I think can come up in terms of the advising situation with students. When they say, what am I going to do with this humanities job? The answer is there are so many things that you can do that we can't specify one particular one, and we can't predict what it's going to be. And that's frequently the case. There's another way I have put this to students I've talked to. At Notre Dame, we have a very flourishing business school for undergraduates, business major for undergraduates, and all sorts of students will say, well, I better get a major in business, although I'd much rather, you know, study Latin literature or study biology for its own sake or something like this. But they want to go into the business college. And I say, well, look, what would you major in if you were in say Harvard or Yale or Princeton, one of the top Ivy League schools? They say, well, I go into business too. And I say, well, the interesting fact is you wouldn't do that because they don't have any undergraduate business majors. Most of the major elite private schools, they might have business colleges for graduate work, but it's not very common for them to have any sort of business major. And their students go into all sorts of different humanistic disciplines or social scientific disciplines or maybe a science and get jobs even in finance and all sorts of business areas. So it obviously is not true that you cannot or some great disadvantage to have majored in humanities if you're trying to get a job in some business-related area, because many, many of the top people in those areas have not had a business education and didn't go to schools where you could get one.
I read something, though. You must have read this, too, that looked at the huge number of Harvard graduates that go directly to Wall Street, no matter what their major may happen to be, which I thought was telling, isn't it? That more so than in past years.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. And, of course, a school like Harvard or Yale and Princeton, they're a special kind of case. A lot of people say, well, they have special connections anyway, you know, and they're going to get those kinds of jobs. But my point is that it proves that you don't need the kind of specialized business training to do those sorts of jobs well, and I think that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Bill in Burlington is next. Hi, Bill.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Similar to the last caller, there's a lot of emotion on this subject for me. I've lived for 25 years making stained glass architecturally, and which is something I love. I have a passion for. Actually, in reverse of what we're talking about, my mother and stepfather got me into this business. So rather than trying to keep me from doing it, they encouraged it. It's been a tough road, though, I have to say. And I guess the one thing, this show is good, and talking about it is good, and it would be great if we could reach out to the corporate people to help them understand that there's times, like, for instance, I'm about to make a stained glass panel for a lady that will go into their summer home of their family. Her husband is terminally ill, and they want to have a panel made that will be in memorial of him, even though he's still alive and everything like that. But it's very emotional for them. There's been other jobs I've done, church windows, large windows, actually, that were very emotional for people. But on the other hand, a lot of times I get the feeling that people just don't think what I do is really worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like, you know, it's a very small niche that I'm in with, you know, doing stained glass.
Yeah.
There's time.
Yeah.
Professor Gutting, you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very strongly about what you're talking about. People do act often like the artistic work, for example, is some kind of icing on the cake that we don't really need. The substance is something else, and it's nice if we can have it. But, you know, we don't really believe that. I'll just have two lines of thought about that. One is that if you just look around you at any of the products that you see in stores or in your own home, there's virtually not a single one of them that was produced simply with its utilitarian value in mind. They are made so that they look nice, are pleasant to handle, to deal with. There's an aesthetic quality to them, and there's a great deal of effort put into that, even on the level of commercial art. We just don't want bare bones. We want things decorated. We want things looking nice. This is just the way that it is. And human beings are like that, and we act like that's not so, but it isn't. It isn't true. So, you know, a church doesn't want to just have a plain window. It wants stained glass windows. People want to have things that are beautiful in their lives. Well, Apple computer gets a lot of support from people, I think, simply because they like the way those devices look. Another example, though, is universities. And this is a point I've tried to emphasize in other places. If the idea is that a university is almost entirely an institution to train people to work at the jobs that they're going to have, well, then we have built them and constructed them in entirely the wrong sort of way, because the heart of any university, as anybody who knows has been there, is a faculty, and the faculty is a bunch of people, consists of a bunch of people, who are trained in highly esoteric disciplines that don't have anything to do in any direct utilitarian way with the jobs that most people are going to have. Now, if what a university is really supposed to be doing is just train people for doing work, well, then hire for your faculty the sort of people that work for the various sorts of commercial trade schools and have them do the training for you. You don't need what we have at universities, namely these people who the faculties who, well, the main job really is to maintain a high level of intellectual culture in our society. That's what we're supporting universities for.
We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. Our guest is Professor Gary Gutting, professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, editor of the Notre Dame Philosophical Reviews, wrote a piece, The Real Humanities Crisis, that was in the New York Times recently. It caught our attention, and that's what we're talking about this hour of the show. We will post that piece on our Facebook page in case you didn't have a chance to see it, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. You can reach us by phone. Bill, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Joel in Green Bay, our next caller. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I am an anesthesiologist who's been in practice for 30 years. As a point of information, I was born with a congenital heart defect, which I had fixed in 1961 when they had just developed the technology to fix such things. And, you know, I basically knew what I wanted to be from the day that happened. Hmm. And I guess I have a specific advantage over those who go into college, kind of undecided what they want to do. I would say that I certainly enjoyed my liberal arts courses, both in high school and in college. I took 2 years of Latin, believe it or not.
Great.
And also did some classical studies and some literature courses and sociology. But I think in this day and age, with the way the economy is, it's vitally important that people who are going into college and are going into significant debt for their college have some real idea of how they're going to pay off that debt and what sort of majors they need to take to make them employable.
I think you make a very... very
it
important
changes
point.
Over time, but right. You know, yeah, healthcare is always a good bet. Business may or may not be a good bet. There's, yeah, but you know, being a starving artist doesn't help much.
He makes a good point, Professor Gutting.
Sure, it's certainly if you talk about the performing arts, that's certainly true. I would like to see what the data are, though, on the actual unemployment rates of students who go to good colleges and get good humanities degrees. I do not believe that there's a huge difference in the employment rate for them. Maybe they don't make as much money. I know they don't make as much money. But this idea of, you know, the student who comes out with a philosophy major and has only thing he really needs to know is, do you want fries with that, as the old joke says. I don't think that's true. I think we translate that fear of not knowing what somebody's going to have, or maybe taking a little longer to hit a firm path. But do you really think that there are the people who are unemployed are not generally college graduates with humanities majors? They're people who dropped out of high school. There are people who have other sorts of problems. There are people who are caught in a highly specialized job that has ceased to exist, right, because of technological developments. That can happen. But is it really true? I think we should ask ourselves, is it really true that your standard humanities graduate of a good college is not going to be able to get any sort of meaningful job and not be able to support himself? I don't think that's true.
And yet we've heard from, maybe not be able to get a meaningful job, but we've heard from people who went back to tech school to get jobs. We heard from a Latin and art history major at Lawrence, a fine university, who's studying massage therapy.
Right.
We have Bridget on Facebook saying, I was a history major and I had to work up to where I wanted to be, but I love my job now. And Joel makes an interesting point that a lot of students are significantly in debt. So to have to then work yourself into the chosen field that you want to be in is problematic for a lot of people. You're still in debt, and your debt's going to be with you for a long period of time. So it may point to a need, as you suggest in the article, that we have that we support the arts in some more significant way and humanities, so all of these people won't have to work in another field for years before they do what makes their soul happy.
Yeah. There's actually two dimensions here, right? The one is, do you have a job that will support you? And I think most humanities majors with the skills they have will get a good job, a reasonable job, and it will support them. The second question is, are you going to have a job that fulfills you? And our last caller, who worked in the medical field, had that, and more power to him. I have the same sort of thing. But there's a difference between having enough to support yourself and have a good living and be fulfilled by the job that you've got. So those are actually two separate problems that are worth separately talking about.
Christina is next in Pleasant Prairie. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for this program. I actually was a history and political science major at McAllister College, which is a private liberal arts school. And while I was in school, I did internships in completely different fields because I realized I didn't want to be a lawyer or a professor at the time. So I did internships in television production, which led me to work in that field for many years. And I feel that I had more dimension than some of the other people entering production because I had a whole nother breadth of knowledge that maybe someone studying just the mechanics of TV production had. In addition to that, I wanted to become a teacher after years in that, and that's what I'm currently doing with some entrepreneurial things. But I feel that a liberal arts degree in the humanities specifically teaches you how to think analytically, how to learn how to learn, so you can learn to do many different jobs very quickly, and also how to, in my case, how to write. I found that my learning how to write helped so much as I looked for careers and
oh, I'm sure it was helpful. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true. That's but you followed a very good strategy given our current situation in particular, because you made yourself use your humanities degree in order to do better level of work and to accomplish more with it. So that's a great thing to do.
Yeah, thanks, Christina, so much for your call. Anita in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi. Anita is gone. Alex in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, gang. How's it going?
All right. How are you, Alex?
Good. So I actually am all over the place with my liberal arts or humanities education, and I want to definitely echo a few of the things that were already said. I've got a double major in philosophy and psychology, and I started out in music, starting in music and then, you know, not agreeing with the career field because I lost the passion. There's definitely a good amount of passion and, you know, humanness to this type of education. But moving into philosophy and psychology, I actually am in a graduate degree program right now for to become a psychotherapist at UWM because I realized, you know, with psychology, an undergraduate degree, there's not really a lot you can do. And once I found that out with regard to the degree field, I moved on to a master's degree, but I kept bartending on the side. I actually got into yoga, too, to try and, you know, blend all these cultural elements. So there are definitely gigs on the side, but and it was a wonderful choice. I'm really happy with it. But I think with regards to the social change, you know, in order to make this get some more societal supported, that's really an important thing. And it just has to be, you know, but more people are getting out there and more people, I think, who are unsatisfied with or dissatisfied with their, you know, their careers in the business world. They'll find a way to blend it all in, I guess.
Thank you, Alex, for the call. We have about a minute left, Professor.
Okay, well, I thought that was a good line of thought that the humanist in a way is the person who has many irons in the fire and many possibilities. Maybe that's what I would like to end on, the thought that the value of a humanities education is perhaps not that it teaches you a whole lot of facts of the scientific sort that you can make use of, but it teaches you about possibilities for going beyond what the current facts are. And so there's a creative dimension to it that opens you up to a whole world of what's possible that you might not ever think of if you just stick to what is and try to make your way in the world mm-hmm. as it is. So the humanists are the people who will transform the world.
Mm. All right. Good note on which to end. Thank you so much. Our guest this hour, Professor Gary Gutting. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, editor of the Notre Dame Philosophical Review, and the column that caught our attention is The Real Humanities Crisis, appeared recently in the New York Times, posted on our Facebook page in case you missed it in the Times, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We ask you to like our page. It's filled with all kinds of information, great articles and opinions from our listeners on a variety of issues. That is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And like us and send that along to your friends. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster and to Lisa Nalbandian for producing this hour.